back when I was doing interviews, for a while I emulated sort of the form of what Marc Maron was doing with WTF. You know, like 90% of the show is the interview, but that first 10%, that's conversational. It's kind of like what the whole show here is, but it just, he would do it at the beginning. So I would try to kind of get into that mode. And what I found was the hardest part, and what I'm finding now is still the hardest part, is figuring out what the first words are going to be. The rest, I'm fine. Once I'm in the episode, once I'm moving, I'm fine. But what are the first words? Because there's this blockage for me. I don't know if everybody has this, but there's this blockage. Like, do I just say hello? Or like the last one, do I say welcome back? Because they all feel performative, cheesy, weird, unnatural. But maybe, I mean, maybe that's the point of them. You know, like people that start off with like catchphrase things. Marques Brownlee, the tech YouTuber. I think every episode he starts with welcome back, everybody. There's another YouTuber whose name I can't remember right now, who would always start with, hey, friends. And I always felt weird about that. Like, oh, if you get too locked into a catchphrase, when does it become too formulaic? You know, when have you lost that originality, that genuineness? But now I understand that maybe they're doing those things just because they have the same problem I do. Figuring out what the first words are going to be. So I don't know. I'm going to stew on that. Obviously, I made it into this episode, okay? So far, you know, I'm going to tell you something. You know what drives me nuts? So I'm using this Zoom H5 recorder. It's technically a field recorder. I'm using that as the audio interface to record because the Scarlett that I had a couple months ago, that I've had for years, it started making this crazy static sound, and I couldn't deal with that. But this, the thing that drives me about this, drives me crazy about this H5 is I'm using Fathead or Fethead, which is it boosts the audio because the microphone I use is notoriously quiet. But the headphone jack on this recorder, it's not made for that. So when I talk about this level, I'm getting distortion in my headphones. But when I go back and listen to the audio, because the audio is not going through that, it's going directly to the computer, it sounds fine. It sounds normal. It sounds perfect. But I have this cognitive dissonance every time that I'm recording, that when I get too loud for the H1 or the H5, I get distortion. So sometimes I think that's why, if you listen to these, I've been tending to get down into this vocal range because I'm training myself to whisper with these headphones right now. So I don't know. I don't know why I had to share that, but it's been driving me nuts. Had to get that out. So, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how this whole thing is working. So far, I like the free formness of it. But one of the things that I've been kind of struggling with, struggling is a heavy word. One of the things I've been puzzling is knowing what is going to make it into the show and what's a tweet. You know, what's something I'm going to put out there and what's something I'm going to bring in here? It's something similar I talked about. So I talked about something like this on one of my previous shows that some of you may be former audience from, which was Brainstorms. I talked about not knowing how to differentiate when I tweeted if it was going to go to one account or the other account. So when I was running four Twitter accounts. And, you know, it's not a big deal. Like I said, it's not a struggle, really. It's a puzzling. But something that rolls around in your head. And I think I figured it out today on accident because I had something and I was looking at it and I'm like, all right, I'm going to bring that into the episode. And then I looked at it and I'm like, but I don't have anything to say about that. That's literally like, just like, I don't know, like two sentences. I'm going to bring two sentences into a podcast episode. That's tweet. And I realized, I'm like, if it's something that's nuanced or requires extrapolation, that's what's going to show up here. But it's something, I mean, there's still a fine line there. There are some things that will still go to Twitter that could qualify as that. But there's just some things that would be exhausting to try to explain on Twitter. So basically what I'm saying is I'm appreciating the experience of watching this, all of these pieces take their own forms and how they all fit together, because you know, I don't have to worry about too much. I built everything to work together. So they do work together. It's just learning. You know, there's something I realized when I was writing down the note to talk about this, I looked at some of my other notes and I realized, I'm like, oh, that actually, that thing that I'm going to talk about, I did talk about on Twitter. But that's the way Twitter is for me. You know, I've mentioned this previously on, I think, Brainstorms as well. When I used to do that show, I would talk about the struggles that I was going through, the challenges I was facing. And one of the challenges was understanding what role social media played in my creation process. And what I came to the conclusion I came to back then, which I still stand by now, is it's like my notebook. It's where I just throw things. And then something can happen with those later if I want, or that can be it. And I think that's what is really interesting right now is I'm putting stuff on Twitter. And then when it comes time to do an episode, I'm like, you know, I have more thoughts on that. I have more things that I want to talk about that thing. And that's kind of interesting to see that interplay, because then it's going out. And then ideally, people are listening to this and they're going to tweet back ideas, sometimes about things that started out on Twitter. So there's this loop that's possible. But we're going to talk a little bit more about something like that later on. I have everything in the set order in front of me, because I'll lose my mind if I don't have at least an arrow to direct me through what I'm going to talk about in every episode. You know, technically everything that I'm talking about today is not related, but I seem to found an order that makes sense to me. And the first thing I have on the list, the first thing on the list is that iTunes is full of alt-right nutbags. I probably shouldn't laugh at it. I don't know if you guys ever go into the iTunes charts and look to see what the top podcasts are, or if that's just something podcasters do. I'm sure it's something just podcasters do. Most people probably don't go look at the charts unless they're maybe looking for something to listen to. But I go in and I noticed that after the election that there was in the top 30 podcasts, about 10 to 12 of them were these alt-right shows that had suddenly shot up into the charts. And some of them are still hovering there. I think the number one show right now is this former Secret Service agent who's just an idiot. I'm not afraid to say that. Just people that are very blind. I shouldn't call him an idiot. He's just blind. They see the world one way, and it's this very narrow view of the world. But I don't get into politics in here. I told you that a couple of episodes ago. But I did have this thought process of why are there people like this? I don't mean people that believe conservative values or stuff like that. I mean this more extreme, narrow perspective that we have termed probably too kindly as the alt-right. why are there, does it seem like there are so many of these people? Because it has been pointed out that there aren't that many, just the ones that are there are really loud. Kind of like on the left. You know, like the right thinks the left is full of people who are just itching to cancel people at every moment. But in reality, there are a small percentage as well. That's why we, refer to people on both of these sides. That's why we refer to them as fringe. They're on the outer edges. The fringe is a small part of the fabric. So, once again, why are these people? Why do they? Let's look at examples. I mean, I don't want to be too abstract here, but I don't want to go into policies and stuff like that. We're not going to talk about that. But these are people who are, like, for example, this Ben Shapiro fellow. He's very angry about this Harry Styles, who, I'm sorry, I don't know who Harry Styles is. But I believe he's a musician. And apparently he took a picture wearing a dress or women's clothes. And anybody that's over the age of 20 knows that this guy did not invent that. David Bowie was cross-dressing. Iggy Pop was cross-dressing. The New York Dolls, their whole gig was that they dressed in women's clothes. Mick Jagger. This is like a long tradition. This playing with androgyny, especially among musicians, but not just musicians in society. You know, J. Edgar Hoover was secretly a cross-dresser. You know, so I'm not saying Harry Styles is a cross-dresser because, once again, I don't know who he is. I'm just saying it's kind of weird. Somebody is, their worldview is so narrow that this really, really bothers them. But that's the question. Why are they like that? And I'm obviously simplifying something that's very complicated because anytime you talk about human beings and you generalize, you're simplifying something that's very complicated. But one of the ideas that came to me is it's easier. Which it sounds strange. And I'm not condoning anything here, by the way. But I'm saying it's easier in the sense that courtesy, caring about how other people view themselves and how they want to be spoken about and how they want to be seen, that requires a considerable amount of care. It requires time. It requires effort. You know, for someone in my age, I'm in my early 40s, I'm just old enough for it to be a little difficult for me to adjust to somebody maybe that used to refer to themselves as a she, now being referred to as a he. I don't have a problem with it, but it takes me a while to adjust that change of pronoun in my head. And because of that, every once in a while, I probably mess up. You know, I may accidentally refer to Caitlyn Jenner as a he. Actually, I've never done that. It's just the most public example I could think of. But more, it's just every time there's a little slip up or I'll say something, because for my 43 years of my life, most of it, I was trained differently. So I'm out learning conditioning. And I'm more than willing and more than happy to do it. I'm more than happy to put that care in. But it takes effort. And some people are not willing to put that effort in. Some people aren't willing to learn new words, learn new ways. They just aren't willing. And it's not even that they're stuck in the past, which, don't get me wrong, there is a considerable amount of this idea, you know, like the word conservative, conserve, saving, holding. That's the original idea of that party or that type of philosophy, to hold on to what is good. But then there are some things that some people don't ever want to let go of, worldviews that they don't want to let go of. But there's a part of that that's also about ease. I don't know why I was thinking about this, but they're thinking about these, a lot of these people that maybe are listening to these podcasts that maybe aren't radicalized, but maybe, you know, like they could be getting radicalized by these shows, but they're just average people surrounded by people who think similarly to them. So they're in this silo, just like people on the left can get into their silos as well. And who are these people? You know, who are the almost 70 million people that voted for Donald Trump? Who are these people? A lot of them are blue collar. A lot of them are farmers. A lot of them, you know, are rural, not urban. What's their life like? You know, like maybe some of them still work in coal mines. Some of them still work in steel factories. Some of them are, a lot of them, construction, truck drivers. These are people that work hard and long. And they have these resistances to these ideas because I think to some degree, because they're tired. I don't want to think about that. It's not an excuse. Like I said, I'm not excusing anything here. But I do see that there's a small part of that where it's like, I don't care. You know, when you're tired and you're hungry, I don't care. Whatever. You say a word wrong. Somebody corrects you. Whatever. I don't care. I think that's part of the mechanism that's going on here. Now, obviously, this isn't a big piece of the puzzle. It's not going to unravel the whole thing or anything like that. It's just an insight that I had. It's just an insight that maybe, I don't remember who said this. Somebody said something along the lines that the reason that people on the right so dislike the left, the extreme left, is because those people are continually telling the people on the right how awful they are and what bad people they are. And here comes this guy, Donald Trump, who's number one, never says that to them, never says that they're wrong or they're bad. And who is a worse person than them? Who's a worse possible example? So he makes them feel good about being unwilling to put the courtesy and the care into other people. You know, and to be fair, like I said, there are people on the left who are just as ignorant to care and courtesy that are willing to cancel people, that are willing to pull a tweet from like 15 years ago and like think that this 140 characters, because back then it was only 140 characters, that this 140 characters defines a person, that somebody can't grow and change in 15 years. Not a lot of them, just like I don't think there's a lot of people like the other way on the right. Like I said, they're just loud. And a really good example of this is when, I don't know if you saw this, but like people all of a sudden decided, I don't know what made them think this, but they thought that Chris Pratt was like this huge Trump follower. And just all of a sudden one day, you know how it happens on Twitter? It's like everybody on Twitter just thinks they discover something one day. So everybody started piling on him and dumping on him. And finally, his Avengers co-stars all had to stand up for him. Like, no, no, no. Number one, this dude is the nicest, kindest, most caring person. And number two, he's like the most apolitical person. Like this is not who he is. And these are people like Robert Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo. You know, this isn't like other people that, you know, like, it's not like Trump supporters came out to support him. These are people on the other side going, no, that's not who this dude is. You're all making a decision based off of no verifiable truth. And I'm guilty of this. That's why I'm bringing this up. I'm guilty of doing this. I did it for years with Vince Vaughn. I heard somewhere that Vince Vaughn was a passionate Trump supporter. And there's somebody like James Woods, right? He's just got his head so far up Trump's ass that I didn't want anything to do with the dude. And now I found out that that whole story about Vince Vaughn that I had heard is not true. That the guy's a libertarian. Like, he doesn't, the only candidate that he's ever supported was Ron Paul. And that the whole story of him being Trump supporter came from him being at a baseball game or something. I think it was a baseball game. And Trump being there and them shaking hands and chatting for a minute. Which he had done the same thing with a Democratic politician that was there as well. Like, they were just two dudes at a baseball game. So, I don't know. I think that right now, it's really important to remember courtesy and care. And that courtesy and care requires effort. And it also requires the effort of looking into things, not just hearing from one person or even all of Twitter, who can be completely wrong. Don't jump on things. You want to take that energy? You want to do something useful? I know something useful you can do. Go on to the Apple Podcast app. Look at the top podcasts. And find in the top 20, find all of the podcasts that are not these alt-right shows. And things like, you know what? Let's look right now. I'll tell you what's there right this second so that you can have some examples. Shows like Do No Harm, The Daily, Crime Junkie, Bill Gates and Rashida Jones, Dr. Death, Up First, My Favorite Murder. Shows like this. Find all of those shows, subscribe to them, and give them 5-star reviews. Why? Because you're going to shoot, they're already high in the charts. You're going to shoot them up. And if you can keep shooting those up, then the other ones are going to drift down. It's not hateful. It's not angerful. It's just a fun little thing to do. And it's a good way to channel some of that energy. And you know, while I'm talking about podcasts, I keep forgetting to do this because I get so wrapped up in the show. But my friend Harak, he was actually, when I was doing interviews on the show, he was one of the people I had on. He has made this podcast app. And the podcast app is called Humbly. If you're looking for it in the podcast, in the app store, it's called Humbly FM in the app store. This is such a great idea. And I wanted to plug this for him. I want you guys to hear about this because it's different than every other podcast app. First of all, I mean, it's a beautiful app. It does all the things you would want a podcast app to do. But what makes it really unique is the purpose, which is why it's called what it's called Humbly, right? He wanted to make something that did something good for the world. And what Humbly does, the principle of Humbly is that, you know, you subscribe to your shows as you would in any other podcast app. But before your podcast plays, Humbly will play you a commercial. And instead of that money from that commercial going to Harak, he's going to take that money and he's going to donate it. So that every time you use the podcast app, you're raising money for charities, for causes. And when you go into the app, there's a section called My Causes. You pick the causes that are important to you. They're grouped into categories like health, animals, social justice. There's like 10 different categories. So instead of just making a product to compete with feature to feature with these other things. He's created an app that puts something else out there that helps other people. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes to help you guys out if you want to check it out. Give it a shot. Run through it. Subscribe to some shows. Pick some causes. Raise some money. And if you like it, you know, tell other people about it too. Because this isn't about promoting an app. This isn't about promoting even my friend, even though I have no problem with promoting my friend. This is about promoting something that does good in the world. And I'm, you know, I'm not a commercial. I'm not getting paid for this. He's a small app developer. This isn't a paid commercial. It's my friend, and he's made something really cool. So go check out Humbly FM, okay? And let me know what you think of it. I want to hear. You know, tag me at The Real Chad Hall and tag Humbly FM, too, on Twitter. Let us both know. Let's hear it. Because feedback's important, too. He's in. This is the first release. So feedback's really important, too. Okay. So, something, you know, something I've been watching recently, not a lot, I watched about 4 episodes of it, is The X-Files. And it feels weird in a way to say that you're watching The X-Files. Because in so many ways, conspiracies, it's a dirty word right now. But I think the reason that I've been watching this is I wanted to remember what it was like when conspiracy was cute. You know, it was like these theories, but it wasn't, it didn't affect the news, you know, that it was just something that people, it was like a hobby, especially like the JFK conspiracy theory people. Like these were basically people's hobbies. You know, I had a friend once, whenever we get together, we theorize about the Zodiac Killer. You know, it's almost like a game in a way. Actually, you know, I ran across something recently. I was going through an old notebook and I found this quote that I had cut out of a magazine. I think it was out of a Mental Floss magazine. And it was by this guy named Will Shorts. This guy's a puzzle master. I'm not positive what a puzzle master is, but I'm pretty sure it's just somebody that's famous or gets paid to solve puzzles. Or make puzzles. I don't know. But he said, why do we like puzzles? I think it's a way of putting the world in order. Every day we're faced with problems. Most of them do not have clear solutions. And we just muddle through. We do the best we can, but we never know if we get the right solution. The great thing about a human-made puzzle is that we can take the challenge through from start to finish. And when we're done, we know we've achieved perfection. We don't get that feeling much in everyday life. And the first thing I thought of when I reread that was that's why people love true crime. And to some degree, back in at least the X-Files days, why they loved conspiracy. Because it was like a way to try to create order out of chaos. That's so much about our lives where there's unanswered questions or ever-evolving problems that are never going to come to a conclusion. But if we can look at these crimes and we can theorize them and we can maybe someday see them solved, you know, that was the allure of Unsolved Mysteries. Maybe you can help solve a mystery. That maybe you can help find an answer, that maybe this thing that's lingering and hovering unsolved will slowly light itself to the ground and become terrestrial, become solved, become understood. That something so hard to understand, like why someone would shoot John F. Kennedy, could one day be resolved. And that all the complicated pieces could be put in place. I've been thinking a lot about that. why questions are so important to me. And it seems like it says, when I say that, the questions are important to me because of the answers, but it's not the answers. It's the promise of answers. That questions are powerful because questions, by their very nature, insinuate that there is an answer. You don't need to know what the answer is, but if you can articulate the question, then you've, in a sense, created the belief in the answer, whatever the answer is. Even if you can't conceptualize the answer, you know that it exists. That we can bring something solid into the hazy and the invisible. And that mindset of the question, I'm continually living in that. That when I see something and it catches me, it's so rarely because it entertains me. It usually catches me, some piece of content, some link, some image, some movie, some moment in a TV show, some line in a book catches me because it triggers a thought process, that it sparks a question that tumbles into more questions and more possibilities. I don't know exactly what I was searching for. So often I go to search for something and I end up in this, long train of links, going to this and going to this and going to this. I never remember why or where I started. What was the first question that I brought to this avalanche of research? It had something to do with notebooks the other day, and I was looking on YouTube. It had something to do with that. And I stumbled across this video of Elizabeth Chatwin, who was the wife of writer Bruce Chatwin. I had actually never heard of Bruce Chatwin before. But she was explaining in this, it's a really brief clip, I'll put it in the notes. She was explaining the way that her husband used his notebooks and how he would take them with him everywhere. And she said she had this offhand comment about phones. I don't even think she was talking about cell phones. I think she was talking about just plain old phones. And she said something along the lines of, I imagine now people with phones, they jump to communication. When they have an idea in their head, they communicate it. This idea, the question that came out of that for me was, what about now? With cell phones, everybody has a cell phone in their pocket, and social media and all these things, we are continually ejecting thoughts the moment that they come to us. What Elizabeth Chatwin was trying to say about her husband's use of notebooks was, because he traveled and he wasn't near phones very often, his thoughts lived with him. They were in his notebook and he carried them around in his head for a while and he lived with them. And she was saying something that she imagined that people didn't need to do that because of phones, because they could call someone and communicate it in an instant. And that got me thinking, like I said, about cell phones and social media. What does that mean? What could that mean? Is it possible that over time, the ability to instantly communicate has affected the quality of our thinking because we don't live with our thoughts for very long anymore? That our thoughts are in our minds only momentarily. It's input, idea, output. Input, idea, output. Input, idea, output. Whereas someone like Bruce Chatwin, it would be like input, idea, mull it over, live with it, mull it over, write it in the notebook, think about it some more, Think about it in the morning. Think about it at night. Maybe someday communicate it. Maybe someday write something with that. I don't know that it's affected our thoughts, but I wonder if it has. That much like instant gratification affects how we deal with desire and with wonder. The thoughts continually moving out of us. Maybe they have finished their thoughts. Let's go back to what we were saying about care and courtesy, time, about finding out whether things that people say about other people are valid. And it reminds me now that I'm talking about this. It reminds me of the 24-hour news cycle and how that changed things. When people were writing for newspapers, they had deadlines, right? But because it was a deadline, you know, it was a daily deadline, sometimes weekly, depending on if they were working on a longer piece, they had time to wait for more news to come in. You know, the president said this. Well, now the president says this. 4 seconds later, it's on Twitter, most of the time from him. But instantaneous news. But the problem with instantaneous news is sometimes what we get in the moment is not the complete picture. This goes, in a way, relates to something that I talked about briefly in the last episode about who was Jennifer Fairgate. This idea that shows like Unsolved Mysteries, stuff like that, when they don't put out the full picture, when they don't give enough information, sometimes they create holes, and from these holes, conspiracy blossoms. The example I gave in that episode was, we don't know if the security guard in that hotel was ever looked into by the police. Therefore, some people might assume that he wasn't, and they may start brewing conspiracies about that person. When in reality, he may have been looked into, done, solved, over with. But we don't know that. So time in reporting was very important, because the difference between what you found out at 9 a.m. and what you found out through the rest of the day, all of that could be worked into your story that you had to get in by your deadline. Whereas, boom, write it in the second. Well, the problem sometimes with tweeting in the second is that people don't catch every successive update that you make. So they may be floating around in their head all day thinking that first tweet that you sent, that wasn't the full picture. So I can't imagine how this doesn't affect our thinking, this momentary, this reactionary almost effect with thinking, that we don't live and stew with them enough. That the quality of our thinking has to be more shallow. I think about something I talked about in an episode of the old show Brainstorms with Lamb. I talked about the hermeneutic circle. The hermeneutic circle is a way of learning that's not linear. What I mean by that, when you think about linear learning, you can think about similar to school, right? First, why do you go to first grade so you can get to second grade? Why do you go to second grade so you can get to third grade? Why do you go to third grade so you can go to fourth grade? It's a continual linear progression towards something. It's the same way people write. Sit down to write something. Here's my beginning. Let me write this to the end, right? Straight line, linear. But the hermeneutic circle is about going back. So you, for example, hermeneutic circle within a reading. You read an article about tilapia farming. When you are reading it for the first time, you have no idea, you know nothing about tilapia farming. So through the process of reading this article about farming tilapia, about raising fish, you learn something you didn't know before. So that when you get to the end, you're more educated on the topic than when you started. Well, if you take that knowledge that you have at the end of the article, and you go back to the beginning and you reread the article, there are things in the article that you will understand the second time through that you couldn't understand the first time because you didn't have the knowledge that the entirety of the article gave you. And you can continue to do that. Go through a third time and a fourth time. And in the hermeneutic circle, you can bring more sources of information in, but you're continually going over and using the process of learning to enrich what you learned from. I hope I explained that well, at least well enough. So I think a lot about that, even going back to what I was saying about tweets, that I can tweet something and then realize a few days later, you're like, you know what? I want to talk about that on the podcast. I want to break that down more. Continually going back to it. And I'm going to tell you something funny. I don't know about you, but so far, remember I said at the beginning of this that everything wasn't connected. I just kind of put things in a linear order. I've messed up the linear order. I've been jumping around because as I've been talking about this, I've been realizing how all these topics relate to each other. I didn't plan it, but they just start fitting together. And that's, I'm going to say that that's because I wrote this down, much like reading that article on tilapia farming. I wrote it down with no knowledge of how it was going to fit together. And I put it into this order. And in the time between me putting it down on this, in this note, in this outline, and me talking about it, some part of my mind has been calculating that, has been making those connections in my subconscious. It's an extraordinary thing that the human brain does. Because the hermeneutic circle, first of all, that's not on here. That just came out. And it relates directly to an item that I have on here, something that I was doing literally before I started to record this episode. So I have this idea of living documents, that there are ideas, that there are things that should be continually written and rewritten. You know, I go back and I look at some of my old writing. I've got writing online that goes back about 8 years. And I read some of that stuff and I don't like a lot of it because I was a very different writer. But the ideas, there's something in the ideas still. And when I see them, I think, I could write that so much better now. And not long ago, I had the thought, well, why don't I? They're not etched in stone. What would happen? Questions again, right? Falling into those questions. What would happen if I took these old pieces and rewrote them? And then the next question was, what if I continually rewrote them? That instead of looking at blogs, like I said, as written in stone or these published pieces, why not look at them more as just words, like in a notebook? I'm not done with it. It's just that's what I'm showing right now. And I puzzled on that for a really long time. How can I make living documents? There's other people that are doing stuff like this. This isn't an original idea by any stretch of the imagination. Most people refer to these things as digital gardens. Andy Matushak is probably one of the more famous or more well-known within that community. He's continually rewriting. There's no publication dates on his website at all. But the problem with that I always saw was they're off when people create digital gardens, they're offloading a lot of responsibility onto the reader. And there's, you know, there's the reasoning. I'm like, well, the people that would be interested in this are the people that are willing to put in the effort. Nobody's willing to put in effort if they don't have to, period. Because the effort it's a limited resource. We talked about effort earlier, right? You're tired. I hate that connection right there. But I just connected alt-right xenophobia, the laziness of alt-right xenophobia with the laziness of intellectual pursuits. But on a purely human, I don't know what I'm saying, biological, but physiological level, they kind of are similar. But nobody wants to expend energy if they don't have to. If there's no other way and they are, it's something that they want, they will do it. Think about it. Do you want to ever pick up your mattress and move it across the house? No. If you've ever moved a mattress, you know that sucks. It's heavy, but it's floppy, and you can't keep a handle on it, and it's like the worst thing to move. But if you lived in a 5x5 room and somebody moved out and said, you can have this room, it's 20 feet by 20 feet, and you said, I really want that, but if I'm going to live in that room, I got to get this mattress up there. And if there was no other way to get that mattress up there except for you dragging it there on your own, you'd do it. But if you could pay somebody else to do it, you would prefer that, wouldn't you? Because nobody wants to expend effort unless they have to. And it's hard enough to get people to read things on the internet as it is. So to offload that effort of people having to come and continually check and say, does this one have any updates? Has this one been changed? It turned me off to the whole idea. So I had this like idea of these living documents that I really loved, but I couldn't figure out how to make it happen. So here's the funny thing. I kind of figured it out. And I kind of figured it out by screwing up and what I thought at first was wasting about 2.5 hours. Speaking of effort. So I had this sudden realization that right now, most of the writing I've been moving to WordPress. And WordPress is not ideal for living documents because it is based around the idea of published pieces. You put something in, it goes, boom, published, and it has a date. That's it. And then the next one comes in, and the next one comes in and moves. They're all moving the old ones down. It's not really conducive. So what I was planning on doing is changing the publication date every time I updated one. So it would move it to the top of the feed so that people could come and see, that one's on the top of it, and it says it's been updated. But that still relies on people coming to the website to look. And I think I'm fairly diligent when it comes to things that I'm interested in reading. But I don't go to websites very often, even websites I love, and go, what's new? Unless I see something that slams me there, or I suddenly think, I want to check in on that. It's not something I do on a regular basis. And you don't want to rely on that. You don't want to rely on people like just happen to remember you or your website. So it's just not conducive. So what struck me yesterday, I think it was, so what if I move it to Substack? If you don't know what Substack is, essentially it's a hybrid of a blog and a newsletter. In the sense that it's a newsletter service, but you're writing it on a blog and all it's doing is mailing the blog to people. So people can read it as a public post, as a blog, and they can subscribe. So it can just be sent to them. And I thought that'll be perfect because I thought it had a feature and it doesn't. I thought when you updated an entry on Substack that it sent another email to your mailing list. I thought, that's perfect. You know, like people could subscribe to this mailing list and they get every time I update something, boom, they get it in their mailbox. They don't have to come look. It comes right to them. So I spent, like I said, about 2.5 hours moving everything that I had, everything that I've been able to pull up from internet database that I had lost, everything that I had that I could find that I had published online in there, stuff from Medium, stuff from WordPress. And then when I got to the end, I realized it doesn't email people when you update. Oh, man. Oh, man. That moment. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Why can't it just update people when I make a change like it does on Patreon? Ding, ding, ding. Wait a minute. Patreon does that? That's right. Anytime you change a post on Patreon, there's a checkbox that says, let your patrons know about this update. And then I realized all these pieces came together. So, oh, that's it. I don't have to, it won't be a waste of moving everything to Substack because that's where the first draft of everything can live. There needs to be an original copy of a living document so everybody can see where it started. And those can live on Substack. But if people like those things, if they read those things and they want to see them evolve, they want to see them move and change over time, then they can become patrons. And when they become patrons, they'll get emails of those updates. And it solves my problem with Patreon because the problem I always have with Patreon and with newsletters and all this other stuff is I hate exclusive content. I'm sorry. I wrote a whole piece about this. But when you make content exclusive, you limit the input that you have from other people. So essentially, you create a silo and you create a cult around yourself of people who mostly agree with you. Because if they didn't, they probably unfollow you, right? But when you put things on the internet and on a public website, anybody can come to that. People who don't agree with you can stumble on there. People who agree with you but see flaws in your logic can stumble on there. People who love you can come on there. You're exposed to all of it. And it makes you a better creator. So I've had a problem trying to figure out like, okay, some people I needed to offer the Patreon for people who support the show because some people trust Patreon and they don't want to contribute via Ko-fi because they've never heard of it. So I brought back the Patreon, but I was like, what am I going to put up there? I don't want to put exclusive content. But this solves the problem. You want to read the ideas, the initial ideas. They're public. They're right there on the Substack I created. But if you want to be involved in the process of seeing it evolve and having more input beyond that first initial draft, then you can become a patron. And any of those pieces, if they ever, I don't expect many of them will, but if they ever get to a place where I'm like, this is done, this doesn't need any more input, then I would put that public again. Because that's, you know, either I would publish it as a book, if it was long enough, or if it was short enough, I'd put it back on the Substack. Make it public, expose it to more people again. The puzzles, those puzzles too, right? Moving the pieces around because they're puzzles. I love it. All right. I do have one other thing. And in a way, it relates to this idea of public and this idea of feedback and the importance of having your process, not only your creative process, but your thought process exposed to other people and their opinions and their expertise and their knowledge. We have copyright laws in this country. I'm sure you're familiar with it. If you've ever tried to post anything on Instagram that has a song in the background and been told you couldn't, copyright law. So there's this documentary that I saw a couple years ago about copyright law. The documentary is called RIP, A Remix Manifesto. And the point of this whole documentary is that copyright law stifles creativity. while I'm not going to be able to articulate his whole point because, I mean, he does it in 2 hours and I have like 2 minutes. Let me give you an example of something. Say you are a hip-hop producer and you hear this awesome little hook. You hear this awesome little hook in a Green Day song. And you go, no, anybody ever made a song out of a Green Day hook? I don't know. And you start playing around with it and you just, and it just evolves into this amazing song. And you're feeling like it's one of the best things you've done in a while, this song. But guess what? Sorry. You can't release that song. Copyright. Because Green Day and Green Day's record label, sorry, it's protected. So what happens to your creativity? What happens to your idea? It's dead, right? What do most artists do in that situation? They try to find something else that fits, like, you know, like, oh, well, I guess this hook over here is kind of similar, and they put it in. And there's a great example of this with RZA from the Wu-Tang. Before there was a Wu-Tang Clan, RZA had a very, very brief solo career. And he had this song. It was under the name Prince Rakim. He had this song that used a sample. And the song, things worked a little bit different than they do now. But like the song was out on the street already. They'd already sold vinyl of this single. And it was hot. The streets were enjoying it. It was a kind of a poppy song, not what you'd expect from Wu-Tang if you've ever only heard Wu-Tang. It's very 90s hip-hop, early 90s hip-hop, late 80s hip-hop, that kind of sound. And song's out. It's doing well. He's thinking he's going to be famous. And copyright violation. The sample gets pulled. So what do they have to do? They have to pull all of those records from the shelves. And then they got to find something else to fill that sample. And they do it, and it's not as good. The song doesn't do as well. Copyright stifles things like that. But if you are a writer, if you're a musician, if you're anybody who has ever created art and tried to make money from it, you rely on copyright because copyright means people can't steal your shit. You want to make money. And this is the whole thing with Metallica, right? Why they were pissed off about what was it called? I don't remember what it was called. Napster. Because they wanted to make the money from the albums. We did the work. We want the money. And I could never, after watching that documentary, I knew they were right about copyright. But I also knew that the other side, that being the artist who doesn't make any money because there's no copyright on your product, sucks. And I could never figure out how you resolve those two. You know, basically the way it would work, at least in the early 2000s, was if you were nobody, you said, rip it, steal it, whatever you want, copy it as many times as you want because you want as many people to hear it as possible. But then once you got to where you could actually make money, then you want everybody to stop. Don't copy it. Don't do that anymore. We need to make money. That's the way it worked. That didn't work very well, right? You piss your fans off at that point. We used to be able to copy it. So for years, I mean, this documentary, I think it's probably about 20 years old. I almost said 2,000 years old. It's from 2000, maybe. I could never resolve it. And it's been something that's been in the back of my mind, especially as a writer. You know, if I put something out and somebody could take a paragraph of something I wrote and make something new from it, that's incredible. But you're like, you know, you want credit. So there's that, hey, that's awesome. You got to make something from it. What do I get out of it? Why are artists like that? Because we're fucking broke. It's really hard to make money as a creator. And it wasn't until recently that I started to see something with Patreon and Ko-Fi and sites like this, crowdfunding sites, I started to realize that what people are doing with it right now is creating communities, right? They're creating fan clubs, essentially. But it's only the beginning of it. That the real, I think the real destiny of sites like this is to eventually allow us to rewrite copyright law. What I mean by that is right now, and for always, making money off of art, making money as a creator, has functioned on product model, has functioned on craft model. I can make shoes. You pay me for shoes that I make. I can write songs. You pay me for songs I've put onto this disc. I can paint. You pay me for this painting. The model has always been that the creator is paid for the end product. But with Patreon and Ko-fi and crowdfunding sources like this, we can change that. And instead, you don't pay for the product that the person creates. You pay them for the time that they spend creating. You pay them to continually be creating, to continually be putting things out. You're not paying for that one song. You're paying for all the hours that they're spending every month sitting at the guitar, sitting at the piano, sitting at the beat-making machine. Beat-making machine. Sitting at the computer. This is something that people should be familiar with from graphic design, right? Why are graphic designers, why is their work so expensive? It only takes them an hour to make that. And this, I think originally this idea came from Pablo Picasso. You're not paying for the hour it took him to make that. You're paying for the years that it took for them to get that good that they could make that in an hour. And crowdfunding sites allow us to pay people for being creative rather than creating a product. They will create products, but it can become a side effect. That having a complete song is really cool, but what might be even cooler is watching that song being born, watching it evolve over time, doing like what I want to do with my writing, watching these pieces evolve over time. So if we can put the focus on paying people to create rather than what they create, then copyright law becomes something that only benefits corporations, people that own parts of other people's creativity. But the artists can get paid and still put their stuff out and say, here you go. If you can make something with this different, go for it. Because I'm being paid to create, and hopefully you can be paid to create too. That's a different model. And I really, really, it really changed my mind. And that's why I think that this whole exclusivity content thing is going the wrong direction with this stuff. What's exclusive? What should be just for the patrons are things that only patrons would be interested in, which is the process. But the product should be public. That the song you create at the end, the song that the done song, that's the thing that anybody should be able to listen to and jam out to. But the people who are really fascinated in your ability to create, they should have access to watching you evolve that song, to hear the demo and hear how it sounds when you first put drums to it, what it sounds like with the rough draft vocals and what it sounds like with the revised vocals. Nobody else is interested in that anyways. So you're not creating this exclusivity club. You're just creating a place where if somebody wants that stuff, it's accessible to them. But if they just want your music, well, that's public. I think that it's only slightly different in some ways, but in some ways it's the complete opposite of the way that people look at these things. And I'm trying to wrap my head around it because for the first time, it solves that problem that presented itself to me in the Remix Manifesto. You know, we're moving into a world where things are going to change drastically. So many machines are going to take jobs. But a machine, it's going to be a long time before a machine is going to be able to create the way a human creates. And even when it does that, I don't know that anyone's going to be interested in the process that they go through. Because what makes the creative process interesting to someone that's a fan of someone else is the struggle. Not only because it reaffirms for us that, yeah, this is hard. Makes us feel good anytime for anything that we've succeeded at. It also makes us feel good for the things that we didn't try. It's like, oh, man, that's hard. I don't know if I could do that. But the struggle is also valuable because of the drama. Will he ever get this song to completion? Will this sculpture ever actually look like the person? Will this drawing ever be beautiful? It's that puzzle again. That resolution that we're seeking, that order from chaos, and watching the process of someone we respect create something, it's like watching a puzzle being solved. It's like watching Twitch, right? Watching someone else play a game. I don't know, we can make all this stuff work together. And I think it's just going to, it's presenting a future for artists, but it's also presenting a solution to so many problems now. So with all of that said, talking about Patreon so much, I'd be an idiot not to plug my own Patreon. If you guys are interested in seeing what I do with these living documents, which I don't even know, it's an idea, haven't even started, but you want to support the show as well, please become a patron. And if you can see a way that I can't even see yet for this process, you know, like this whole thing I've been talking about, showing the process, if you can see another way for me to satisfy that, like maybe there's part of the process in putting these episodes together that I'm missing that's worth other people seeing and sharing it, let me know. Because of course, I would want to do that. Why wouldn't I? One of the other things that I'm doing over there is I'm sharing stuff that people would normally share in a newsletter. Like, hey, I just checked this out and it's really cool. I just listened to this podcast. You know, like stuff, you know, like people are always, what do they call it? Curating stuff for their newsletter. I thought, why put that in a newsletter? Just like put that on Patreon. Not everybody's interested in that. But the people that are, it'll be there for them. So that's what I'm doing over there. But what my grandest hope for that Patreon is to make it into a community. It's not something I can do. It's something I have to hope other people do. So I can do all of the mechanics of making it a community, but if I'm the only one there, it's not really a community. So it's only something other people can do. The only thing that can happen when people show up. But what I hope for that is that just like what I hope with Twitter, you know, like I put my rough draft ideas like a notebook onto Twitter, hoping for other people to feed into it. When I put out these episodes, I always ask you guys, go over to Twitter and follow The Real Chad Hall and give me constructive feedback and tell me your knowledge and let me hear your questions. Because I'm looking for input, because that input is something that I want to feed into my hermeneutic circle. That as I circle back through things, I'm not just circling over my own thoughts and creating this silo, this narrow tunnel vision like the alt-right, that other people are continually feeding things in there. then I discover new colors. Well, I think that that can become something like Twitter, but to the next level on Patreon. Because, you know, Twitter, you know, maybe you go back and forth like 3 or 4 times with somebody on Twitter. But at a certain point, because it's all public, you kind of stop. But if you've got something like a discourse server, those things can just keep going. They can be ongoing conversations and not just with me, you know, because I have a bunch of stuff. I'm not going to be in discourse all day, but maybe you're at work, you know, you're working at home. Maybe you have discourse open and there's other people in that discourse who are in the same situation and you guys talk all day. That's community. You know, it's not centered around me. So that's what I'm hoping, that I can create something that's as valuable for other people. But we'll see what happens. You know, I can't make people show up. All I can do is think about it. I have these ideas of what's possible. All I can do is make the space. All I can do is clear the runway and see what lands. Is that enough metaphors? That's 2 metaphors to make the same point. My voice is slowly getting raspier and drier. And as you know, that's usually my exit cue. Well, we're at 120, I mean, an hour and 20 minutes. Yeah, should be my exit cue. I did have a lot of stuff on the platter. So I hope you guys dug this. I hope that you will follow me on Twitter. I hope you'll check out the Patreon. I hope that you will share this episode, that you guys are into the new format as much as I am. And until the next episode, go and think about something and don't tell anyone about it. Just stew on it and run it through your head. See what happens.